cities are spending big bucks on green infrastructure, like rain gardens, to help solve sewage overflow problems.
At a bare minimum, you're going to want to measure how much water is coming into your green infrastructure system and how much is going out of it.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, researchers try to figure out if investments in green infrastructure will pay off. And a family moves to Pittsburgh and gets a whiff of complacency around dirty air.
When I mention my air quality concerns to Pittsburghers, most laugh it off. The air is fine. You should have seen it before.
Plus, what do area hunters think of turning over federal public lands to the states? Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. After failing to pass a natural gas severance tax for the last 2 years, Governor Tom Wolf is hoping the third time could be the charm. State Impact Pennsylvania's Katie Culinary reports Wolf is planning to ask for a tax on Marcellus shale drillers during his budget address next month.
During an event in Philadelphia, Wolf said the tax is key to making sure communities hours away from the nearest gas well also benefit.
I want to be able to say to the people in Delaware County, if you support reasonable and environmentally correct expansion of the gas industry, this is going to help your schools.
Last year, Wolf failed to pass a 6.5% severance tax at a time when natural gas production and prices were tanking. The governor would not say what tax rate he's proposing this year, but hinted it may be somehow tied to the price of gas. He says the details are still being worked out with the legislature and the industry, which has beaten back every other severance tax proposal in the state. Katie Culinary, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
By now, most of us are aware of the plight of honeybees, their populations devastated by habitat loss and pollution. But for the first time in the U.S., a bumblebee has been listed as an endangered species. Rebecca Williams has more.
The rusty-patched bumblebee used to be found all over the eastern U.S. and Midwest. Now, it's only found in small populations in Ontario and just over a dozen states, including Pennsylvania and Ohio. Georgia Parham is with the Midwest region of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
It appears that the species, which was quite a common species up until the late 1990s, but researchers started to notice that they weren't finding it as often as the years went by.
She says the agency was petitioned to list the bee.
We did a status review and found that its abundance had dropped by like 87%, which is a huge drop in a short period of time.
Parham says the bumblebee is an extremely good pollinator. It pollinates wildflowers and crops such as tomatoes and cranberries. She says a number of things appear to be driving the bee's decline. For one thing, the bees have lost a lot of the prairie habitat they like, but there could be other factors.
There's concerns about use of pesticides. There's a thought that possibly pathogens or disease from other bee colonies might be affecting it. And also concerns about climate change, because climate change can intensify weather events that can affect this bee population.
She says the agency is working to keep the bee from going extinct, and she says everyone can help.
One thing about this particular bee is the places where it's still found, and there aren't that many of them, but where it is still found, some of these places are in urban areas, and people can help by, you know, planting bee-friendly native plants in their backyard.
She says the bumblebee is one of the first bees to come out in the spring.
The queens hibernate in the wintertime. They're the first to come out in the spring and the last to go in the fall. So they need flowers all spring, summer, and fall.
Parham says another way to help the bees is to leave some debris in your garden over the winter. That gives them some habitat for hibernation. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Pittsburgh, like many cities, is turning to green infrastructure to reduce flooding and sewer overflows. As part of the Allegheny Front series Headwaters, Exploring the Ohio River Watershed, Ashley Murray reports that the next challenge is determining if these green projects actually work, especially with the threat of climate change.
In Philadelphia, they're spending more than $1 billion on green infrastructure, planting more than 700 trees to soak up stormwater. In Cincinnati, they're bioengineering a stream to stop pollution from getting into the Ohio River. And next year, Pittsburgh is planning a dozen projects on the East End, Things like special pavement that soaks in water so it doesn't rush into the sewer system. The cost? $10 million. Big bucks, but it's a lot less than new sewer pipes and treatment systems. The question now is, will green actually work as well as the traditional gray infrastructure? John Buck is a soil scientist who's showing me how researchers are figuring this out. We met at Chatham University's Eden Hall campus north of Pittsburgh, where Buck was digging holes with a big fence post digger.
22 might be our destination depth.
Buck isn't building a fence, though. He's putting metal sensors into the holes to measure how water moves through the layers of soil.
The sensors are going to be laid in probably about 3 inches below ground surface, 12 inches and 20 inches below ground surface. And from there, we can see how fast it's moving through the soil.
Buck and his students bury the sensors, leaving long wires sticking out of the ground. They plug those wires into a sensor hub, and it kind of looks like a circuit breaker zip-tied to a wooden pole. Thanks to wireless communication, Buck can check those soil readings at any time, right from his phone.
It's telling me that the most recent reading was today at 4:10, and it tells me the status of every sensor.
And that will tell policymakers whether rain gardens, green roofs, or porous pavement can solve their city's water problems.
At a bare minimum, you're going to want to measure how much water is coming into your green infrastructure system and how much is going out of it. And the difference between those two things are what your effectiveness is.
Buck helps monitor several urban projects. One rain garden in Pittsburgh's East Liberty neighborhood captured almost all, 99%, of stormwater runoff last year. It even handled what experts called a, quote, once in a 167-year storm this past August, when the garden soaked up nearly 3 inches of rain in just 2 hours. That effectiveness is important in regions like Pittsburgh, where untreated sewage regularly drains into the river after it rains. The Environmental Protection Agency is pushing sewer districts to reduce overflows into the waterways. And in Allegheny County and elsewhere, it's requiring the use of green infrastructure to help solve the problem. There are already a lot of small green infrastructure projects in Pittsburgh and other cities, but the science of monitoring them is pretty new. Researchers are still figuring out the best ways to test how well it works.
The more monitoring data that we have, the better we'll be able to determine how successful it is in capturing stormwater runoff.
That's Beth Dutton. She works at Three Rivers Wet Weather. She's clicking on a map that has about 200 little colored dots. Each signifies a rain garden, bioswale, or green roof. She's been cataloging these at schools, hospitals, and apartment buildings, finding them from colleagues or reading about them in the newspaper.
If you click on the blue square, you'll see the project name, the project size, volume, how much roof water runoff is being collected. We went around and we snapped pictures of the installed green infrastructure.
How many of these projects on this map are being monitored?
There are actually not that many that have been monitored simply because it's so expensive to set up the monitoring, and it has to be done over a significant period of time because you want to capture the different seasons, a couple good storms.
As cities spend millions, some billions, on these projects, it's the job of people like James Stitt to make sure they're working. Stitt is with the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority. To start monitoring, he says, they need to know how much stormwater is getting into the system in the first place.
We're putting some monitors in the sewer pipes in the ground and getting some calculations on what those annual volumes are in that area before we do anything. Then we're going to continue to monitor that for another year after construction. Every project we do, we want to learn more about how to do this more correctly and more effectively.
Pittsburgh's multi-year Green First plan is expected to keep 1 billion gallons out of the combined sewer system per year. That's about 10% of the problem in Allegheny County. But for people worried about flooding and sewage overflows, there's climate change. It's predicted that storms will get bigger with increased rainfall. But Stitt thinks the green projects will fare well.
One of the great things about green infrastructure is that it's much more adaptive in those situations than a tunnel project or a large pipe project. That's a stagnant solution. It's always going to be that size. The green infrastructure, we can play around with it a little more. It's a little more flexible.
Stitt says cities with more experience have found that as rain gardens and bioswales mature, they actually become more effective. That adaptability is one reason the EPA is pushing for more green projects. to help flood-prone regions manage extreme weather. Robert Traver of Villanova University monitors green infrastructure with the EPA in Philadelphia. He says their projects are performing better than expected, even on wet days.
I might be looking at 1 inch of rain or 2 inches of rain. That doesn't happen that often in a year. So if I have a couple more of those events, it's probably going to work. If you have a little more intensity, you have to take a look at it. If I'm talking about a hurricane, that's another story.
For example, Traver said a change in rainfall might call for different types of plants in a rain garden or a constructed wetland.
So in some of the cases, these systems are more resilient and are actually, I think, going to be much better for climate change than some of the past practices that we've used.
He says as storms get more intense, green infrastructure won't be able to eliminate all of the overflows alone. Cities will need a combination of both gray and green. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Ashley Murray.
Green and gray infrastructure will help cities and communities handle the rising tide of climate change. How we'll deal with the impacts of climate change is something that the Army Corps of Engineers has been grappling with for decades, especially as it relates to managing the nation's waterways. I spoke with Gus Drum in the Corps' Huntington, West Virginia office. He's been working on a climate adaptation plan for the Ohio River Basin. It's based on an initial pilot study. The basin stretches from the headwaters here in Pennsylvania to the Mississippi, and the adaptation plan comes out later this year. Drum says what's expected on the Ohio, based on 9 climate models used by federal agencies to assess climate impacts on water, is over the next decades in the headwaters region, it will gradually get warmer and wetter.
In terms of precipitation, the Allegheny gets progressively wetter, especially in the springtime. We do see increases in precipitation, as much as 25%, potentially more precipitation in the outer years, which would essentially result in higher stream flows.
With that much more water, what kinds of things are you looking at in a climate adaptation plan?
There are 83 Corps of Engineers dams in the Ohio River Basin. 78 of those actually have a summer pool. Each of those dams were designed primarily in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And at that time, because they had a rather limited historic context for the hydrology and hydraulics, they designed inside the construction of the dams huge safety factors for storage. The projects that are out there right now, like Kinzu and several other the dams in the Allegheny, actually have a fairly large factor of safety for storage of floodwater. In terms of adaptation strategies, in terms of safety, what we might be looking at are changes in the water control manuals for several of those projects, which each one has a water control manual of how the project's supposed to be operated under certain conditions. We would probably make changes potentially to address climate change, to adapt to that, by changing the water control manuals for the storage and release of water. But in terms of safety, there's over 100 local protection projects, there are flood walls and levees, that protect an awful lot of communities up and down the Ohio River that otherwise could be flooded. There is a concern amongst many of the climatologists that we could be facing more intense thunderstorm activity than we've seen in the past. They may be less frequent, but they'll be more intense. So there is the risk in some cases of potential for more flash flooding in areas that have steep gradient streams and mountainous areas. We do have some levees and flood walls that have a specific crest height of protection. So there is a little concern there whether or not some of these changes, especially in the out years, where there is a high level of uncertainty, of whether or not those crest heights would be high enough to handle some of these new rainfall events. All of this revolves around how much money it costs to put those adaptation procedures in place and what's the return on investment to the nation when we begin to do that.
Drum says though the Corps' dams are old, they'll likely be repaired or addressed before the worst climate impacts are expected. He says when the temperatures rise, there actually might be some benefits for more rain and water flow in the Ohio Basin for some fish and freshwater mussels.
Certainly more water is going to be a good thing. They would rather have more than less. And again, the reservoirs and other projects in there would be operated in accordance with the Clean Water Act and the other agreements that we've had with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Pennsylvania Game and Fish people. And we would try and maintain as best of our ability those flows coming out of the reservoir to sustain the aquatic species to do as little damage as possible based on changing climate or precipitation. Obviously, the warmer weather, warmer air temperatures eventually would begin to result in warmer water temperatures. I think the team has thought that the reservoirs actually will be a blessing in disguise in those situations. A lot of the reservoirs are very deep, so they contain an awful lot of cold water down at the bottom. And in those times when air temperatures may increase water temperatures, the water coming out of those reservoirs will be cool enough to maintain temperatures downstream that otherwise may have gotten too warm for a number of species.
The Ohio River is characterized as a working river. It doesn't seem to get as much attention or federal funding as others. From your perspective, how important is the Ohio in terms of industry and natural resources?
Well, certainly for the region, it's extremely important. It moves as much as 270 million tons of cargo every year on the Ohio River and its tributaries. It's a huge transportation network for various commodities, raw materials, and various things that support the economy here in the region. Obviously, for recreation, it's huge. 5 million people use it for water supply. There are a number of thermoelectric power plants that withdraw water out of the river to create electric energy. There's a number of hydroelectric power plants at the locks and dams on the Ohio River. There are about 400 power plants in the basin, and they produce electricity that spreads across the grid for many states. It's a huge resource for this region. Nationally, you know, at Cairo, Illinois, 60% of the flow in the Mississippi River comes out of the Ohio River. If something happens to the Ohio River, the Mississippi's in trouble. It either has too much water and there's flooding, or there's not enough water and there's no navigation. So, yeah, in terms of its effect on the country, it's huge. It's huge.
Do you think your work will change under the new administration?
Let me just say this. The Corps of Engineers is part of the U.S. Army. And we're beholden to the executive branch and Congress to what we're authorized to do and allocated money to do.
Gus Drum is with the Huntington District of the Army Corps of Engineers. He says they'd like to reevaluate their plans for the Ohio every 5 years based on the latest climate models. That interview is part of the Allegheny Front series, Headwaters, exploring the Ohio River's vast water resources. We're producing Headwaters with West Virginia Public Broadcasting. There are more stories, interviews, and a video at AlleghenyFront.org/headwaters. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. Some hunters and anglers are concerned that the new Trump administration will promote energy development on public lands at the expense of air and water. But other outdoor enthusiasts take a different view of the industry.
You aren't going to stop it, so the second best thing to do is to get on board and be involved with these energy companies to promote proper land reclamation.
Later on the Allegheny Front, we visit a hunting camp to find out how a family tradition and politics get along around the campfire. Stay tuned. Pittsburgh's Renaissance is getting national attention. Its growth in technology and medicine brings people from all over the world to live and work in the city once known for steel mills. But one newcomer, Donna Carol Roberts, had a rude awakening: Pittsburgh's poor air quality.
It's 2:30 a.m. on Tuesday, and I can't sleep. My mind is racing, thinking of all the things I need to do the next day for my work and for my 18-year-old son Gabriel, who has higher functioning autism. Just as I'm drifting off, here comes the familiar stench of early morning air pollution. I get up and close my windows. Gabriel coughs upstairs, making me worry. He has sleep disorders, though, so I won't close his window. I'm afraid it might wake him. This scenario plays out nearly every week in our home in the Point Breeze neighborhood of Pittsburgh. Usually, the stench wakes me from a deep sleep. We first moved here 3 years ago to access resources for autism, resources that didn't exist in Southwest Florida or Sao Paulo, Brazil, our two most recent homes. When I first noticed the early morning odor, my husband thought I was imagining things. Finally, when he started reading other accounts of Pittsburgh's air pollution, he went out and bought air purifiers, one for each floor. We moved them from room to room as needed. Here's the irony. I'm a documentary filmmaker with a master's degree in environmental sciences.
Before making a decision to move, we researched different states and cities where our son's needs would be met, determined to find a good place to call home where we could all thrive as a family. We settled on Pittsburgh after learning about all the great resources available here for youth with autism. That Pittsburgh was dubbed most livable city for raising a family and for retiring baby boomers sealed the deal. Naively, I assumed that to get such distinctions, decent air and water quality were givens. When I was awakened those first early mornings, I thought there would be some intense rush hour at Penn and Fifth, because the stench actually resembled weekday mornings in Sao Paulo, a city of nearly 20 million people. When I mention my air quality concerns to Pittsburghers, most actually laugh it off. The air is fine. You should have seen it before. I'll never forget how at a local conference on autism disorders organized by a respected organization, a courageous doctor drew links between the region's air pollution and autism. I started to cry. No one else in the room seemed upset. In fact, I overheard someone call the doctor crazy. Well, call me crazy, but I just can't understand how city buses display slogans shouting, "From steel to sustainable," when our air quality is among the worst in the nation, and our water now apparently has lead. Don't get me wrong, I love Pittsburgh. I love the arts and culture, the parks, the great old trees, our neighborhood, the philanthropic spirit, the food. I've become an ambassador to our city. And I try not to talk about our air, at least with those outside of Pittsburgh. Because frankly, I'm embarrassed for us. A lovely, revitalized, mid-sized city like ours should not compete with Sao Paulo when it comes to air quality. Hey, at least we have water. As contaminated as it may be in some places, we don't have water shortages. We all need clean air, water, and food to live. I can afford filters. I can move if things get too bad. But many people can't. And a healthy environment should not be a social justice issue. It's a human right, right? For the Allegheny Front, I'm Donna Carol Roberts.
Donna Carol Roberts is a documentary filmmaker based in Pittsburgh. Her commentary was first published at Public Source, our investigative news partner. Check out their primer on air pollution and some more of their environmental reporting. There's a link at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. As the inauguration approaches, we're continuing to talk with voters who supported President-elect Donald Trump and also have deep ties to the outdoors and environmental issues. One of the first initiatives passed by House Republicans when they came back in January was a provision to make it easier for the federal government to give up control of public lands to states. Many of the most avid users of these lands, hunters and anglers, are on edge about the idea. But the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant spent some time with one Pennsylvania hunter who says there's no reason to worry because energy development has been good for game hunting.
On the Sunday before buck hunting season started in late November, Randy Santucci, chair of a group called the Unified Sportsmen of Pennsylvania, got up early to talk and show me some of his hunting sites.
Julie, hi. Randy Santucci. Nice to meet you. Nice to meet you.
Santucci is in his 50s and owns a machine shop in Robinson Township near the Pittsburgh airport. He's a big guy wearing a camo shirt, a ball cap, and he hasn't shaved in a while.
We are about 3 miles out of Titty Ute, Warren County, northwest Pennsylvania, at our camp here. Pretty typical of the thousands of camps across the northern tier of Pennsylvania. This is the big weekend for deer season, which kind of is the one that everybody waits for all year. The whole group here is all family. You know, my brother, my nephew, my cousin.
So these guys sleep in, or?
Yeah, we did our annual campfire. We do it every Saturday night before deer season, and we cook out over the fire. Just have a nice family get together laughing. And so they'll be up shortly. They've got a lot of scouting to do and things today.
We hop into his pickup to get the lay of the land and talk about the coming political changes. Donald Trump has said he wants more energy development on federal lands, and this worries some hunters. Groups like the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers fear that leasing public lands for oil and gas wells will destroy wildlife habitat and the solitude of being in the woods. But not Santucci, and he wants to show me why. Oil and gas drilling hasn't been a bad thing for his hunting. We drive down an access road, and he points into the woods.
There are wells strewn all through here.
Pennsylvania's game lands have been used for energy development for decades. There are thousands of working oil and gas wells in the nearby Allegheny National Forest. Santucci says his hunting group was early to support drilling.
You aren't going to stop it. So the best thing, next second best thing to do is to get on board and be involved with these energy companies to promote proper land reclamation.
Santucci says land that's cleared for drilling actually benefits hunting. After four-wheeling some rough roads, we walk into the woods toward another well site.
Some of the most beautiful hemlock woods that you'll find anywhere in Pennsylvania.
The roads built for well pads provide access to spots like this.
You're miles and miles from the forest road. There's no possible way to hunt it. You couldn't get the deer out. Especially older hunters. You know, obviously, I'm not in great shape. You know, I can't go long distances and dragging deer, but I can get back here and get off the road a little bit.
And once the forest has been cut to make way for drilling, he says the brush that grows back is actually better for hunting species like deer and rough grouse.
You know, you don't want it in your backyard, because some guys will say, well, geez, they ruined my favorite hunting spot because they put this well in or they cut a pipeline. But as the years go by, the game comes back in, and the trees start to canopy over the edges of the pipelines a little, and, you know, and it basically created food and cover for game.
It might not be surprising that Santucci supported Donald Trump for president. Most of his hunting buddies did too. They even have a deer head on their camp wall wearing one of those red Make America Great Again ball caps. Santucci isn't worried that Trump's calls to cut environment and energy regulations will do much harm. He thinks the energy industry is already well-regulated, maybe over-regulated, in efforts to protect water quality and ensure drill sites are cleaned up.
I know Trump talked about relaxing some, changing, you know, every one regulation he was going to get rid of two. Well, I'm sure those ones that he's going to remove are probably the ones that are the least intrusive from a standpoint of causing any concerns to the environment. There's a lot of overregulation.
Other hunting groups across the country are not as confident as Santucci and the United Sportsmen of Pennsylvania that land and water will remain protected. Groups like Trout Unlimited have issued dire warnings to hunters and fishermen about the Republican Party's goal to transfer federal lands to the states. The group worries that once states take over public lands, hunting grounds, and other natural areas, they'll be leased or sold, and then they're gone for good. Even Trump and his pick to lead the Interior Department, Ryan Zinke, have so far not supported these land transfer efforts. As Randy Santucci and his son show me their guns, they say they're not really worried about it. They just want to hang out and hopefully bag a buck. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. And subscribe to our podcast so you'll never miss an episode. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.